kind of virus, I believe, that affected the brain and caused a particularly nasty death. Although a cure was eventually found, it was too late to turn back the clock. And anyway, synthetic foods were now far cheaper, and you could get them in any flavor you liked. Remembering weeks of satisfying but unexciting meals, Poole had strong reservations about this. For why, he wondered, did he still have wistful dreams of spare ribs and cordon bleu steaks? Other dreams were far more disturbing, and he was afraid that before long he would have to ask Anderson for medical assistance. Despite everything that was being done to make him feel at home, the strangeness and sheer complexity of this new world were beginning to overwhelm him. During sleep, as if in an unconscious effort to escape, he often reverted to his earlier life, but when he awoke, that only made matters worse. He had traveled across to America Tower and looked down, in reality and not in simulation, on the landscape of his youth. And it had not been a good idea. With optical aid, when the atmosphere was clear, he'd got so close that he could see individual human beings as they went about their affairs, sometimes along streets that he remembered. And always, at the back of his mind, was the knowledge that down there had once lived everyone he had ever loved. Mother, father, before he'd gone off with that other woman, dear Uncle George and Aunt Lil, Brother Martin, and not least a succession of dogs, beginning with the warm puppies of his earliest childhood and culminating in Ricky. Above all, there was the memory and mystery of Helena. It had begun as a casual affair in the early days of his astral training, but had become more and more serious as the years went by. Just before he had left for Jupiter, they had planned to make it permanent, when he returned. And if he did not, Helena wished to have his child. He still recalled the blend of solemnity and hilarity with which they had made the necessary arrangements. Now, 1,000 years later, despite all his efforts, he had been unable to find if Helena had kept her promise. Just as there were now gaps in his own memory, so there were also in the collective records of mankind. The worst was that created by the devastating electromagnetic pulse from the 2304 asteroid impact, which had wiped out several percent of the world's information banks, despite all backups and safety systems. Poole could not help wondering if, among all the exabytes that were irretrievably lost, were the records of his own children. Even now, his descendants of the 30th generation might be walking the earth, but he would never know. It helped a little to have discovered that, unlike Aurora, some ladies of this era did not consider him to be damaged goods. On the contrary, they often found his alteration quite exciting. But this slightly bizarre reaction made it impossible for Poole to establish any close relationship. Nor was he anxious to do so. All that he really needed was the occasional, healthy, mindless exercise. Mindless, that was the trouble. He no longer had any purpose in life, and the weight of too many memories was upon him, echoing the title of a famous book he had read in his youth, and often said to himself, "I am a stranger in a strange time." There were even occasions when he looked down at the beautiful planet on which, if he obeyed doctor's orders, he could never walk again, and wondered what it would be like to make a second acquaintance with the vacuum of space. Though it was not easy to get through the airlocks without triggering some alarm, it had been done. Every few years, some determined suicide made a brief meteoric display in the Earth's atmosphere. Perhaps it was just as well that deliverance was on its way, from a completely unexpected direction.
"Nice to meet you, Commander Poole, for the second time."
"I'm sorry, don't recall. But then I see so many people."
"No need to apologize. First time was out round Neptune."
Captain Chandler! Delighted to see you. Can I get something from the auto chef?
Anything with over 20% alcohol will be fine.
And what are you doing back on Earth? They told me you never come inside Mars orbit.
Almost true, though I was born here. I think it's a dirty, smelly place. Too many people. Creeping up to 1 billion again.
More than 10 billion in my time. By the way, did you get my thank you message?
Yes, and I know I should have contacted you, but I waited until I headed sunwards again. So, here I am. Your good health.
As the captain disposed of his drink with impressive speed, Poole tried to analyze his visitor. Beards, even small goatees like Chandler's, were very rare in this society, and he had never known an astronaut who wore one. They did not coexist comfortably with space helmets. Of course, a captain might go for years between EVs, and in any case, most outside jobs were done by robots, but there was always the risk of the unexpected, when one might have to get suited in a hurry. It was obvious that Chandler was something of an eccentric, and Poole's heart warmed to him.
You've not answered my question. If you don't like Earth, what are you doing here?
Oh, mostly contacting old friends. It's wonderful to forget hour-long delays and to have real-time conversations. But, of course, that's not the reason. My old rust bucket is having a refit up at the Rim shipyard, and the armor has to be replaced. When it gets down to a few centimeters thick, I don't sleep too well.
Armor?
Dust shield. Not such a problem in your time, was it? But it's a dirty environment out round Jupiter, and our normal cruise speed is several thousand clicks a second. So there's a continuous, gentle pattering, like raindrops on the roof.
You're joking.
Course I am. If we really could hear anything, we'd be dead. Luckily, this sort of unpleasantness is very rare. Last serious accident was 20 years ago. We know all the main comet streams, where most of the junk is, and are careful to avoid them, except when we're matching velocity to round up ice. But why don't you come aboard and have a look around before we take off for Jupiter?
I'd be delighted. Did you say Jupiter?
Well, Ganymede, of course. Anubis City. We've a lot of business there, and several of us have families we haven't seen for months.
Poole scarcely heard him. Suddenly, unexpectedly, and perhaps none too soon, he had found a reason for living. Commander Frank Poole was the sort of man who hated to leave a job undone, and a few specks of cosmic dust, even moving at 1,000 kilometers a second, were not likely to discourage him. He had unfinished business at the world once known as Jupiter. Part 2. Goliath. Chapter 14. A Farewell to Earth. Anything you want, within reason, he had been told. Frank Poole was not sure if his hosts would consider that returning to Jupiter was a reasonable request. Indeed, he was not quite sure himself, and was beginning to have second thoughts. He had already committed himself to scores of engagements weeks in advance. Most of them he would be happy to miss, but there were some he would be sorry to forego. In particular, he hated to disappoint the senior class from his old high school. How astonishing that it still existed, when they planned to visit him next month. However, he was relieved and a little surprised when both Indra and Professor Anderson agreed that it was an excellent idea. For the first time, he realized that they had been concerned with his mental health. Perhaps a holiday from Earth would be the best possible cure. And most important of all, Captain Chandler was delighted.
You can have my cabin, he promised. I'll kick the first mate out of hers.
There were times when Poole wondered if Chandler, with his beard and swagger, was not another anachronism. He could easily picture him on the bridge of a battered three-master, with skull and crossbones flying overhead. Once his decision had been made, events moved with surprising speed. He had accumulated very few possessions, and fewer still that he needed to take with him. The most important was Miss Pringle, his electronic alter ego and secretary, now the storehouse of both his lives, and the small stack of terabyte memories that went with her. Miss Pringle was not much larger than the handheld personal assistants of his own age, and usually lived, like the old West's Colt 45, in a quick-draw holster at his waist. She could communicate with him by audio or brain cap, and her prime duty was to act as an information filter and a buffer to the outside world. Like any good secretary, she knew when to reply in the appropriate format. "I'll put you through now," or, much more frequently, "I'm sorry, Mr. Poole is engaged. Please record your message and he will get back to you as soon as possible." Usually, this was never. There were very few farewells to be made, though real-time conversations would be impossible owing to the sluggish velocity of radio waves. He would be in constant touch with Indra and Joseph, the only genuine friends he had made. Somewhat to his surprise, Poole realized that he would miss his enigmatic but useful valet, because he would now have to handle all the small chores of everyday life by himself. Daniel bowed slightly when they parted, but otherwise showed no sign of emotion, as they took the long ride up to the outer curve of the world-circling wheel, 36,000 kilometers above Central Africa. "I'm not sure, Dim, that you'll appreciate the comparison, but do you know what Goliath reminds me of?" They were now such good friends that Poole could use the captain's nickname, but only when no one else was around.
"Something unflattering, I assume."
"Not really. But when I was a boy, I came across a whole pile of old science fiction magazines that my Uncle George had abandoned. Pulps, they were called, after the cheap paper they were printed on. Most of them were already falling to bits. They had wonderful garish covers, showing strange planets and monsters, and of course, spaceships. As I grew older, I realized how ridiculous those spaceships were. They were usually rocket-driven, but there was never any sign of propellant tanks. Some of them had rows of windows from stem to stern, just like ocean liners. There was one favorite of mine with a huge glass dome, a space-going conservatory. Well, those artists had the last laugh. Too bad they could never know. Goliath looks more like their dreams than the flying fuel tanks we used to launch from the Cape. Your inertial drive still seems too good to be true. No visible means of support, unlimited range and speed. Sometimes I think I'm the one who's dreaming." Chandler laughed and pointed to the view outside.
"Does that look like a dream?"
It was the first time that Poole had seen a genuine horizon since he had come to Star City, and it was not quite as far away as he had expected. After all, he was on the outer rim of a wheel 7 times the diameter of Earth, so surely the view across the roof of this artificial world should extend for several hundred kilometers. He used to be good at mental arithmetic, a rare achievement even in his time, and probably much rarer now. The formula to give the horizon distance was a simple one. The square root of twice your height times the radius, the sort of thing you never forget, even if you wanted to. Let's see, we're about 8 meters up, so root 16, this is easy, say big R is 40,000, knock off those 3 zeros to make it all clicks, 4 times root 40, just over 25. Well, 25 kilometers was a fair distance, and certainly no spaceport on Earth had ever seemed this huge. Even knowing perfectly well what to expect, it was uncanny to watch vessels many times the size of his long-lost discovery lifting off, not only with no sound, but with no apparent means of propulsion. Though Poole missed the flame and fury of the old-time countdowns, he had to admit that this was cleaner, more efficient, and far safer. Strangest of all, though, was to sit up here on the rim, in the geostationary orbit itself, and to feel weight. Just meters away, outside the window of the tiny observation lounge, servicing robots and a few space-suited humans were gliding gently about their business. Yet here inside Goliath, the inertial field was maintaining standard Mars G.
"Sure you don't want to change your mind, Frank?" Captain Chandler had asked jokingly as he left for the bridge. "Still 10 minutes before liftoff."
"Wouldn't be very popular if I did, would I?
No, as they used to say back in the old days, we have commit. Ready or not, here I come.
Poole felt the need to be alone when the drive went on, and the tiny crew, only 4 men and 3 women, respected his wish. Perhaps they guessed how he must be feeling to leave Earth for the second time in 1,000 years, and once again to face an unknown destiny. Jupiter Lucifer was on the other side of the sun, and the almost straight line of Goliath's orbit would take them close to Venus. Poole looked forward to seeing with his own unaided eyes if Earth's sister planet was now beginning to live up to that description after centuries of terraforming. From 1,000 kilometers up, Star City looked like a gigantic metal band around Earth's equator, dotted with gantries, pressure domes, scaffolding holding half-completed ships, antennas, and other more enigmatic structures. It was diminishing swiftly as Goliath headed sunwards, and presently Poole could see how incomplete it was. There were huge gaps spanned only by a spider's web of scaffolding, which would probably never be completely enclosed. And they were now falling below the plane of the ring. It was midwinter in the northern hemisphere, so the slim halo of Star City was inclined at over 20 degrees to the sun. Already Poole could see the American and Asian towers as shining threads stretching outwards and away beyond the blue haze of the atmosphere. He was barely conscious of time as Goliath gained speed, moving more swiftly than any comet that had ever fallen sunwards from interstellar space. The Earth, almost full, still spanned his field of view, and he could now see the full length of the Africa Tower, which had been his home in the life he was now leaving. Perhaps, he could not help thinking, leaving forever. When they were 50,000 kilometers out, he was able to view the whole of Star City as a narrow ellipse enclosing the Earth. Though the far side was barely visible, as a hairline of light against the stars, it was awe-inspiring to think that the human race had now set this sign upon the heavens. Then Poole remembered the rings of Saturn, infinitely more glorious. The astronautical engineers still had a long, long way to go before they could match the achievements of nature. Or, if that was the right word, Deus. Chapter 15. Transit of Venus. When he woke the next morning, they were already at Venus. But the huge, dazzling crescent of the still cloud-wrapped planet was not the most striking object in the sky. Goliath was floating above an endless expanse of crinkled silver foil, flashing in the sunlight with ever-changing patterns as the ship drifted across it. Poole remembered that in his own age there had been an artist who had wrapped whole buildings in plastic sheets. How he would have loved this opportunity to package billions of tons of ice in a glittering envelope. Only in this way could the core of a comet be protected from evaporation on its decades-long journey sunwards.
"You're in luck, Frank," Chandler had told him. "This is something I've never seen myself. It should be spectacular. Impact due in just over an hour. We've given it a little nudge to make sure it comes down in the right place. Don't want anyone to get hurt."
Poole looked at him in astonishment. "You mean, there are already people on Venus?"
"About 50 mad scientists near the South Pole. Of course, they're well dug in, but we should shake them up a bit, even though Ground Zero is on the other side of the planet, or I should say, Atmosphere Zero. It will be days before anything except the shockwave gets down to the surface."
As the cosmic iceberg, sparkling and flashing in its protective envelope, dwindled away towards Venus, Poole was struck with a sudden, poignant memory. The Christmas trees of his childhood had been adorned with just such ornaments, delicate bubbles of colored glass. And the comparison was not completely ludicrous. For many families on Earth, this was still the right season for gifts, and Goliath was bringing a present beyond price to another world. The radar image of the tortured Venusian landscape, its weird volcanoes, pancake domes, and narrow, sinuous canyons, dominated the main screen of Goliath's control center, but Poole preferred the evidence of his own eyes. Although the unbroken sea of clouds that covered the planet revealed nothing of the inferno beneath, he wanted to see what would happen when the stolen comet struck. In a matter of seconds, the myriad of tons of frozen hydrates that had been gathering speed for decades on the downhill run from Neptune would deliver all their energy. The initial flash was even brighter than he had expected. How strange that a missile made of ice could generate temperatures that must be in the tens of thousands of degrees. Though the filters of the viewport would have absorbed all the dangerous shorter wavelengths, the fierce blue of the fireball proclaimed that it was hotter than the sun. It was cooling rapidly as it expanded, through yellow, orange, red. The shock wave would now be spreading outwards at the velocity of sound, and what a sound that must be! So in a few minutes, there should be some visible indication of its passage across the face of Venus. And there it was, only a tiny black ring, like an insignificant puff of smoke, giving no hint of the cyclonic fury that must be blasting its way outwards from the point of impact. As Poole watched, it slowly expanded, though owing to its scale there was no sense of visible movement. He had to wait for a full minute before he could be quite sure that it had grown larger. After a quarter of an hour, however, it was the most prominent marking on the planet. Though much fainter, a dirty gray rather than black, the shockwave was now a ragged circle more than 1,000 kilometers across. Poole guessed that it had lost its original symmetry while sweeping over the great mountain ranges that lay beneath it. Captain Chandler's voice sounded briskly over the ship's address system. "Putting you through to Aphrodite Base. Glad to say they're not shouting for help." "Shook us up a bit, but just what we expected. Monitors indicate some rain already over the Nokomis Mountains. It will soon evaporate, but that's the beginning. And there seems to have been a flash flood in Hecate Chasm. Too good to be true, but we're checking. There was a temporary lake of boiling water there after the last delivery." "I don't envy them," Poole told himself, "but I certainly admire them. They prove that the spirit of adventure still exists in this perhaps too comfortable and too well-adjusted society."
"And thanks again for bringing this little load down in the right place. With any luck, and if we can get that sunscreen up into sync orbit, we'll have some permanent seas before long, and then we can plant coral reefs to make lime and pull the excess CO2 out of the atmosphere. Hope I live to see it."
"I hope you do," thought Poole in silent admiration. He had often dived in the tropical seas of Earth, admiring weird and colorful creatures so bizarre that it was hard to believe anything stranger would be found, even on the planets of other suns.
"Package delivered on time,
and receipt acknowledged," said Captain Chandler with obvious satisfaction. "Goodbye, Venus. Ganymede, here we come."
Miss Pringle, File, Wallace.
"Hello, Indra. Yes, you were quite right. I do miss our little arguments. Chandler and I get along fine, and at first the crew treated me, this will amuse you, rather like a holy relic. But they're beginning to accept me, and have even started to pull my leg. Do you know that idiom? It's annoying not to be able to have a real conversation. We've crossed the orbit of Mars, so radio round trip is already over an hour. But there's one advantage. You won't be able to interrupt me. Even though it will take us only a week to reach Jupiter, I thought I'd have time to relax. Not a bit of it. My fingers started to itch, and I couldn't resist going back to school. So, I've begun basic training all over again, in one of Goliath's mini-shuttles. Maybe Dim will actually let me solo. It's not much bigger than Discovery's pods, but what a difference. First of all, of course, it doesn't use rockets. I can't get used to the luxury of the inertial drive and unlimited range. Could fly back to Earth if I had to, though I'd probably get... Remember the phrase I used once and you guessed its meaning? Stir crazy. The biggest difference, though, is the control system. It's been a big challenge for me to get used to hands-off operation. and the computer has had to learn to recognize my voice commands. At first it was asking every 5 minutes, "Do you really mean that?" I know it would be better to use the brain cap, but I'm still not completely confident with that gadget. Not sure if I'll ever get used to something reading my mind. By the way, the shuttle's called Falcon. It's a nice name. And I was disappointed to find that no one aboard knew that it goes all the way back to the Apollo missions, when we first landed on the moon. There was a lot more I wanted to say, but the skipper's calling. Back to the classroom. Love and out. Store. Transmit. Hello, Frank. Indra calling, if that's the right word, on my new thought writer. Old one had nervous breakdown. Ha ha. So be lots of mistakes. No time to edit before I send. Hope you can make sense. Comm set. Channel 103. Record from 12:30. Correction, 13:30. Sorry. Hope I can get old unit fixed. New all my shortcuts and breathes. Maybe should get psychoanalyzed like in your time. Never understood how that Freudian nonsense lasted as long as it did. Reminds me. Came across late 20th Defin other day. May amuse you. Something like this. Quote, psychoanalysis, contagious disease, originating Vienna, circa 1900. Now extinct in Europe, but occasional outbreaks among rich Americans. Unquote. Funny? Sorry again. Trouble with thought writers. Hard to stick to point. It said 12 pounds W888888 stars JS9812YEBDC. Damn. Stop. Back up. Did I do something wrong then? We'll try again. You mentioned Daniel. Sorry, we always evaded your questions about him. Knew you were curious, but we had very good reason. Remember you once called him a non-person? Not bad guess. Once you asked me about crime nowadays, I said any such interest pathological. Maybe prompted by the endless, sickening television programs of your time. Never able to watch more than a few minutes myself. Disgusting. Door. Acknowledge. Oh, hello, Melinda. Excuse. Sit down. Nearly finished. Yes. Crime. Always some. Society's irreducible noise level. What to do? Your solution? Prisons. State-sponsored perversion factories, costing 10 times average family income to hold one inmate. Utterly crazy. Obviously something very wrong with people who shouted loudest for more prisons. They should be psychoanalyzed. But let's be fair. Really no alternative before electronic monitoring and control perfected. You should see the joyful crowd smashing the prison walls then. Nothing like it since Berlin 50 years earlier. Yes, Daniel. I don't know what his crime was. Wouldn't tell you if I did. But presume his psych profile suggested he'd make a good... What was the word? Ballet? No, valet. Very hard to get people for some jobs. Don't know how we'd manage if crime level zero. Anyway, hope he's soon decontrolled and back in normal society. Sorry, Melinda. Nearly finished. That's it, Frank. Regards to Dimitri. You must be halfway to Ganymede now. Wonder if they'll ever repeal Einstein so we can talk across space in real time. Hope this machine soon gets used to me. Otherwise, be looking around for genuine antique 20th century word processor. Would you believe, once even mastered that Q-W-E-R-T-Y-U-I-O-P nonsense, which you took a couple of 100 years to get rid of? Love, and goodbye. Hello, Frank, here I am again, still waiting acknowledgement of my last... Strange you should be heading towards Ganymede and my old friend Ted Kahn, but perhaps it's not such a coincidence. He was drawn by the same enigma that you were. First, I must tell you something about him. His parents played a dirty trick, giving him the name Theodore. That shortens, don't ever call him that, to Theo. See what I mean? Can't help wondering if that's what drives him. Don't know anyone else who's developed such an interest in religion. No, obsession. Better warn you, he can be quite a bore. By the way, how am I doing? I miss my old think writer. It seemed to be getting this machine under control. Haven't made any bad... What did you call them? Bloopers? Glitches? Fluffs? So far, at least. Not sure I should tell you this, in case you accidentally blurt it out, but my private nickname for Ted is the Last Jesuit. You must know something about them. The Order was still very active in your time. Amazing people, often great scientists, superb scholars, did a tremendous amount of good as well as much harm. One of history's supreme ironies, sincere and brilliant seekers of knowledge and truth, yet their whole philosophy hopelessly distorted by superstition. XUEDN2K3JNDER21EIDJDWPP. Damn. Got emotional and lost control. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party. That's better. Anyway, Ted has that same brand of high-minded determination. Don't get into any arguments with him. He'll go over you like a steamroller. By the way, what were steamrollers? Used for pressing clothes? Can see how that would be very uncomfortable. Trouble with think riders. Too easy to go off in all directions, no matter how hard you try to discipline yourself. Something to be said for keyboards, after all. Sure, I've said that before. Ted Kahn. Ted Kahn. Ted Kahn. He's still famous back on Earth for at least two of his sayings. Civilization and religion are incompatible. And... faith is believing what you know isn't true. Actually, I don't think the last one is original. If it is, that's the nearest he ever got to a joke. He never cracked a smile when I tried one of my favorites on him. Hope you haven't heard it before. It obviously dates from your time. The dean's complaining to his faculty. Why do you scientists need such expensive equipment? Why can't you be like the maths department, which only needs a blackboard and a waste paper basket? Better still, like the Department of Philosophy. That doesn't even need a waste paper basket. Well, perhaps Ted had heard it before. I expect most philosophers have. Anyway, give him my regards, and don't, repeat, don't get into any arguments with him. Love and best wishes from Africa Tower. Transcribe, store, transmit, pool. Chapter 16. The Captain's Table. The arrival of such a distinguished passenger had caused a certain disruption in the tight little world of Goliath, but the crew had adapted to it with good humor. Every day, at 1800 hours, all personnel gathered for dinner in the wardroom, which in zero-G could hold at least 30 people in comfort, if spread uniformly around the walls. However, most of the time the ship's working areas were held at lunar gravity, so there was an undeniable floor, and more than 8 bodies made a crowd. The semicircular table that unfolded around the auto chef at mealtimes could just seat the entire 7-person crew, with the captain at the place of honor. One extra created such insuperable problems that somebody now had to eat alone for every meal. After much good-natured debate, it was decided to make the choice in alphabetical order, not of proper names, which were hardly ever used, but of nicknames. It had taken Poole some time to get used to them. Bolts, structural engineering. Chips, computers and communications. First mate. Life, medical and life support systems. Props, propulsion and power. And stars, orbits and navigation. During the 10-day voyage, as he listened to the stories, jokes, and complaints of his temporary shipmates, Poole learned more about the solar system than during his months on Earth. All aboard were obviously delighted to have a new and perhaps naive listener as an attentive one-man audience, but Poole was seldom taken in by their more imaginative stories. Yet sometimes it was hard to know where to draw the line. No one really believed in the golden asteroid, which was usually regarded as a 24th-century hoax. But what about the Mercurian plasmoids, which had been reported by at least a dozen reliable witnesses during the last 500 years? The simplest explanation was that they were related to ball lightning, responsible for so many unidentified flying object reports on Earth and Mars.
But some observers swore that they had shown purposefulness, even inquisitiveness, when they were encountered at close quarters.
Nonsense, answered the skeptics. Merely electrostatic attraction.
Inevitably, this led to discussions about life in the universe, and Poole found himself, not for the first time, defending his own era against its extremes of credulity and skepticism. Although the Aliens Are Among Us mania had already subsided when he was a boy, even as late as the 2020s, the space agency was still plagued by lunatics who claimed to have been contacted or abducted by visitors from other worlds. Their delusions had been reinforced by sensational media exploitation, and the whole syndrome was later enshrined in the medical literature as Adamski's disease. The discovery of TMA-1 had paradoxically put an end to this sorry nonsense by demonstrating that though there was indeed intelligence elsewhere, it had apparently not concerned itself with mankind for several million years. TMA-1 had also convincingly refuted the handful of scientists who argued that life above the bacterial level was such an improbable phenomenon that the human race was alone in this galaxy, if not the cosmos. Goliath's crew was more interested in the technology than the politics and economics of Poole's era, and were particularly fascinated by the revolution that had taken place in his own lifetime. The end of the fossil fuel age, triggered by the harnessing of vacuum energy. They found it hard to imagine the smog-choked cities of the 20th century, and the waste, greed, and appalling environmental disasters of the oil age.
Don't blame me, said Poole, fighting back gamely after one round of criticism. Anyway, see what a mess the 21st century made. There was a chorus of, what do you means, around the table. Well, as soon as the so-called Age of Infinite Power got underway, and everyone had thousands of kilowatts of cheap, clean energy to play with, you know what happened. Oh, you mean the thermal crisis. But that was fixed. Eventually, after you'd covered half the Earth with reflectors to bounce the sun's heat back into space, otherwise it would have been as parboiled as Venus by now.
The crew's knowledge of third millennium history was so surprisingly limited that Poole, thanks to the intensive education he had received in Star City, could often amaze them with details of events centuries after his own time. However, he was flattered to discover how well acquainted they were with Discovery's log. It had become one of the classic records of the space age. They looked on it as he might have regarded a Viking saga. Often he had to remind himself that he was midway in time between Goliath and the first ships to cross the Western Ocean. On your day 86, Stars reminded him at dinner on the fifth evening, you passed within 2,000 K of asteroid 7794 and shot a probe into it. Do you remember?
Of course I do, Poole answered rather brusquely. To me, it happened less than a year ago.
Oh, sorry. Well, tomorrow we'll be even closer to 13445. Like to have a look? With auto guidance and freeze frame, we should have a window all of 10 milliseconds wide.
A hundredth of a second.
That few minutes in Discovery had seemed hectic enough, but now everything would happen 50 times faster.
How large is it? Poole asked.
30 by 20 by 15 meters, Stars replied. Looks like a battered brick.
Sorry we don't have a slug to fire at it, said Props. Did you ever wonder if 7794 would hit back?
Never occurred to us. But it did give the astronomers a lot of useful information, so it was worth the risk. Anyway, a hundredth of a second hardly seems worth the bother, thanks all the same.
I understand. When you've seen one asteroid, you've seen them.
Not true, Chips. When I was on Eros,
as you've told us at least a dozen times.
Poole's mind tuned out the discussion, so that it was a background of meaningless noise. He was 1,000 years in the past, recalling the only excitement of Discovery's mission before the final disaster. Though he and Bowman were perfectly aware that 7794 was merely a lifeless, airless chunk of rock, that knowledge scarcely affected their feelings. It was the only solid matter they would meet this side of Jupiter, and they had stared at it with the emotions of sailors on a long sea voyage skirting a coast on which they could not land. It was turning slowly end over end, and there were mottled patches of light and shade distributed at random over its surface. Sometimes it sparkled like a distant window as planes or outcroppings of crystalline material flashed in the sun. He'd remembered also the mounting tension as they waited to see if their aim had been accurate. It was not easy to hit such a small target, 2,000 kilometers away, moving at a relative velocity of 20 kilometers a second. Then, against the darkened portion of the asteroid, there had been a sudden, dazzling explosion of light. The tiny slug, pure uranium-238, had impacted at meteoric speed. In a fraction of a second, all its kinetic energy had been transformed into heat. A puff of incandescent gas had erupted briefly into space, and Discovery's cameras were recording the rapidly fading spectral lines, looking for the telltale signatures of glowing atoms. A few hours later, back on Earth, the astronomers learned for the first time the composition of an asteroid's crust. There were no major surprises, but several bottles of champagne changed hands. Captain Chandler himself took little part in the very democratic discussions around his semicircular table. He seemed content to let his crew relax and express their feelings in this informal atmosphere. There was only one unspoken rule: no serious business at mealtimes. If there were any technical or operational problems, they had to be dealt with elsewhere. Poole had been surprised and a little shocked to discover that the crew's knowledge of Goliath's systems was very superficial. Often he had asked questions which should have been easily answered, only to be referred to the ship's own memory banks. After a while, however, he realized that the sort of in-depth training he had received in his days was no longer possible. Far too many complex systems were involved for any man or woman's mind to master. The various specialists merely had to know what their equipment did, not how. Reliability depended on redundancy and automatic checking, and human intervention was much more likely to do harm than good. Fortunately, none was required on this voyage. It had been as uneventful as any skipper could have hoped. When the new son of Lucifer dominated the sky ahead. Part 3. The Worlds of Galileo. Extract. Text only. Tourist Guide to Outer Solar System. V-219.3. Even today, the giant satellites of what was once Jupiter present us with major mysteries. Why are four worlds orbiting the same primary and very similar in size so different in most other respects? Only in the case of Io, the innermost satellite, is there a convincing explanation. It is so close to Jupiter that the gravitational tides constantly kneading its interior generate colossal quantities of heat. So much indeed that Io's surface is semi-molten. It is the most volcanically active world in the solar system. Maps of Io have a half-life of only a few decades. Though no permanent human bases have ever been established in such an unstable environment, there have been numerous landings, and there is continuous robot monitoring. For the tragic fate of the 2571 expedition, see Beagle 5. Europa, second in distance from Jupiter, was originally entirely covered in ice and showed few surface features except a complicated network of cracks. The tidal forces which dominate Io were much less powerful here, but produced enough heat to give Europa a global ocean of liquid water in which many strange life forms have evolved. In 2010, the Chinese ship Tian touched down on Europa on one of the few outcrops of solid rock protruding through the crust of ice. In doing so, it disturbed a creature of the Europan abyss and was destroyed. See Spacecraft Tian, Galaxy, Universe. Since the conversion of Jupiter into the mini-sun Lucifer in 2061, virtually all of Europa's ice cover has melted, and extensive volcanism has created several small islands. As is well known, there have been no landings on Europa for almost 1,000 years, but the satellite is under continuous surveillance. Ganymede, largest moon in the solar system, diameter 5,260 kilometers, has also been affected by the creation of a new sun, and its equatorial regions are warm enough to sustain terrestrial life forms, though it does not yet have a breathable atmosphere. Most of its population is actively engaged in terraforming and scientific research. The main settlement is Anubis, population 41,000, near the South Pole. Callisto is again wholly different. Its entire surface is covered by impact craters of all sizes, so numerous that they overlap. The bombardment must have continued for millions of years, for the newer craters have completely obliterated the earlier ones. There is no permanent base on Callisto, but several automatic stations have been established there. Chapter 17. Ganymede. It was unusual for Frank Poole to oversleep, but he'd been kept awake by strange dreams. Past and present were inextricably mixed. Sometimes he was on Discovery, sometimes in the Africa Tower, and sometimes he was a boy again, among friends he had thought long forgotten. "Where am I?" he asked himself as he struggled up to consciousness, like a swimmer trying to get back to the surface.